Welcome back, everyone. This is Season 2, Episode 2 of Go Forth, a music education talk show. This is Owen.
And this is Summer. Today we have an interview with Dr. Juliet Hess. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Go Forth, the music education show brought to you by the students of the Centerman Conservatory of Music based in Gettysburg College. My name is Logan Shippey, and I am honored to have Juliet Hess on the show today. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well myself. So how did you start making music, and how did you become a professional in that field? Like, what inspired you? What drove you to do that?
I wanted to do music from the time I was a very young child, and was inspired by like child-based performers, you know, performers who were specific to, you know, making music for children. And that was music that I loved when I was a child. My mother was a double bassist and she was a professional. And so I came by it pretty naturally. Like, music was always in my house, and started taking piano lessons with my mom and continued taking piano lessons with my mom for 13 years. If you can imagine doing that with your parent for 13 years.
Oh my goodness.
And took voice lessons when I was in high school, and then entered school for voice. Actually really struggled at that stage. I found a teacher who wrecked my voice in short order, and I left school with no instrument to speak of. And so I don't know that I ever would say that I was a professional musician, because really school eliminated any chance that I would have had of doing that. And so I think, you know, my path at the same time, like, I was introduced to Ghanaian music when I was in university, and that very much became my life and my professional identity. And we can critique that all we want. Like, I've gone to town on that before, because it certainly, you know, I got embedded in a culture that really wasn't mine, and it changed my life and changed my experience, and has been really influential in how I write and how I think about music and different engagement with different musics. So that was a pivotal experience. And I think, you know, having that experience made me much more interested in facilitating musical experiences for others than actually being up on a stage. Like, that was never something that held really power for me. Like, that wasn't where I was headed. So I think, I mean, teaching felt natural and was something that I was interested in and was doing kind of all the way through school as well. And I have teaching experiences that date back to when I was 12. Like, I remember kind of tutoring a neighborhood girl when I was quite young. So teaching was something that I did my whole life.
Outstanding. Thank you for that. Now, I thought we could take this time and go and have a little bit of a discussion about one of your articles, specifically Decolonizing Music Education, Moving Beyond Tokenism. So I think it would be a great idea, just for some of our listeners who aren't as familiar with this concept, to give them a sort of baseline knowledge. I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners how a curriculum can be a colonizer.
Sure. I mean, as I just mentioned to you, I wrote the article in 2010 and it was published in 2015. So my thinking is quite a bit different now than it was. And I'm now much more specific about the way that I use the word colonize, because I think it is intricately related to colonization that is ongoing in this country and in Canada, which is where I'm from, and that we need to be thinking about issues of land as well as the more kind of cultural ways that things get colonized. So I think, you know, in terms of curriculum, when we base our curriculum in Eurocentric ideals, that we are perpetuating a model that excludes many people from the curriculum. And I think, you know, in terms of replicating relations that have been harmful, curriculum is really good at that. And when we center voices that have traditionally been centered over and over and over again, we just reinscribe those same hierarchies. So I think that's something that I worry about when we're shaping curriculum. Like, how can we create a curriculum that integrates multiple voices, that brings different perspectives in a way that does not marginalize or colonize different voices at the table?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that maybe some teachers haven't especially from my experience, I've seen teachers that probably haven't thought about how the curriculum is colonizing and maybe do certain things that they don't realize are actually kind of harmful. Could you give some specific examples of how some activities that we might deem as normal are actually colonizing and harmful for our students?
Well, I think everything is contextual, so that's yes. important to consider. Eurocentric traditions do leave out a fair segment of the population. So when we engage, for example, in band, orchestra, choir, we're perpetuating a tradition that is dominated by predominantly dead white men. And continuing that tradition, it leaves people out. It can be harmful depending on what you're talking about. And then, you know, like the movement against blackface minstrelsy songs, like, for example, like those songs are integrated into elementary music. They are everywhere in our method books. And actually working against some of that material, I think that that material is explicitly harmful to students. And that as teachers, we need to actually teach against that. And, you know, there's no reason to engage with these songs. They don't need to be in our curriculum. And I still see people like that. Yesterday, there was a discussion on the music teacher's page about Jingle Bells, and someone pointed out its roots in minstrelsy. There was quite a discussion, and certainly a lot of people were triggered by it because they want to continue to engage with Jingle Bells. But I think, you know, from my perspective, like there are other songs, like just do other songs. And there are plenty of great songs out in the world that are not rooted in a tradition that is racist and oppressive and extremely harmful. And that's not a tradition that I want to be replicating. So I think, you know, in such cases, I don't know that I would call that colonial, but I certainly would call that oppressive. I think that's where I'm sitting more with that article now. Like rather than call it colonial, I think I probably would call it oppressive.
Sure. I think it's important to point out that maybe these teachers that are kind of arguing for Jingle Bells aren't doing it because they themselves are racist and want to be oppressive, but that's just what they've known growing up. And it's like such a strange thing, like even a thought to get rid of a song that I've sung my entire life. It can be really hard to do that.
You know better, do better.
Yeah, of course. So as you said that your thinking has changed maybe quite a bit from 2010 to now. I was wondering how your thoughts on curriculum building have changed or stayed the same since you wrote that article, you know, 10 years ago.
I mean, I think the models that I put forward, and they come from Women's Studies and Sandra Mahanti. And I think, you know, we should be thinking about music in relation to other music, thinking from across different traditions of how things are in each other. So I think, you know, I do stand by that integrative music, the comparative music practice, the final model. But, you know, the first two models are not explicitly, those are not things that we want to aspire to. Like music in the course is not something that we want to be perpetuating in our classroom. Any music that we do that's outside of our own knowledge as teachers, whatever that knowledge happens to be, we all have knowledge of different traditions, and that varies from teacher to teacher. But I think when we engage with the practices outside of our scope, we want to do that in a way that honors history and that deeply contextualizes it and puts it into context of the students as well. So we're not approaching it from a theoretical perspective. So that model is kind of an anti-model. It's not super helpful. Same with musicians, explorer, like we can do better.
I'm wondering if you would have some, I'm thinking about the response that some teachers might have when hearing about like a comparative music model and not being comfortable with teaching music that they're not, you know, experts on, and they might be fearful of being accused of like cultural appropriation, or exactly, they might not even feel comfortable teaching it. Do you have any advice?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, in terms of education, I think that's a conversation. And that we can absolutely center the ideas of cultural appropriation in the classroom and talk about it and talk about the dangers and the risks and actually have that conversation in the classroom. And I think that's a way of engaging with that very difficult topic rather than avoiding it and just hoping that we're not doing it. Like, I think there's always a risk of cultural appropriation whenever you're engaging with something that isn't yours, whatever that means. And because that risk is ever present, I think having a conversation about it and being explicit about it is the way to go. So that's what I would advocate for. But in terms of like just engaging with different musical practices, I think, you know, we put a lot on teachers. And I think at this point, like it's fairly, maybe not expected, but like it's fairly common for teachers to be bi-musical, like to practice usually Western classical music, because that's the nature of our conservatory higher ed system. And one other music, like for me, it's Ghanaian drumming and dancing. That's another music that I'm deeply fluid in. And I probably could count Western popular music in there too, as I'm pretty comfortable in that tradition. But I think most teachers probably could claim, you know, expertise in more than one tradition, usually two. But I think like multi-musicality is a really big expectation on teachers, like to ask teachers to be really competent in more than two traditions is, I don't know that that's a fair ask. I think that's something that we can work on and we can aspire to. And certainly that's something that I've worked on in my life. Like I've studied multiple musical traditions, and I don't know that I would claim expertise in some of the traditions that I studied, but I've certainly studied extensively. I think, you know, that leaves us to present ourselves as a learner in these traditions. Like we're not necessarily going to teach everything from the position of an expert. It's just impossible. Like we can't possibly know that much about so many different musical traditions. But I think if we approach them with humility and as a learner and work alongside students to get to know a musical practice, that might be an approach that has a little bit more integrity than claiming expertise when you don't really have it.
And maybe bringing experts in to the classroom, whether they, you know, be your students or other professionals in the field. Super great. I was wondering if we could touch, we talked about the three models of curriculum a little bit. I was wondering if you could talk about some of the pitfalls in music as a tourist and music as an explorer or musician as an explorer models.
Sure, it's been a while. So I think the musician as tourist practice basically lets do music from around the world in the classroom and taking a little bit from here and a little bit from there, but not really contextualizing it or putting it in relation with music from the West. So I think the trick to doing a more contemporary or contextualized practice is actually putting the power relations in play. Like tourism doesn't engage with power at all. But I think when we take music from somewhere else, we have to engage with power because that's an act of power. And I think, you know, as we're thinking through how to avoid being a musician as tourist, then, you know, the way we do that is to actually implicate ourselves in the power relations that of doing, you know, a music from elsewhere that isn't ours, whatever that happens to mean for each individual. The musician as explorer practice is more of a, like, again, this is from women's studies, and it's more of an everywhere but here approach. So it's an approach that might take music from a lot of different places, but exclude, you know, whatever the home music is from the conversation, which also negates any conversation about power, because of course, music's in schools the way they are now in this country, it's predominantly a band, orchestra, choir paradigm. And, you know, to not have a conversation about how that is the musical practice that has come to be historically and presently privileged is to miss an opportunity for a music education that actually engages with power. So I think that's the crux of those two models.
Yeah, the idea of just skirting around like the obvious like hierarchy in the music and not actually, you know, bringing out like and actually speaking on it. I think that's very powerful, and it reminds me of another study that you did where you talked about race in the classroom. And I was wondering if some of these same principles applied to bringing race into the classroom.
Well, I think what I advocated for in that work was really the use of direct language and, you know, to actually name race in the classroom and to not have it be, you know, I worry a lot about euphemisms, the way we throw around words like culture and at risk and things that mean something very specific, but don't actually say it. And I think, you know, that plays really well with doing different musics in the classroom and actually engaging with them, because it allows us to name what we're talking about. We can explicitly name power. We can talk about race. We can talk about the fact that a music is embedded in a particular culture practiced by a particular group of people. And we can use specific language to identify all those things. So I think those concepts actually do play really well together.
And so we've talked a lot about your past research today, and I was wondering, what do you have in the works? What's coming out in the next couple of years?
Well, I just finished proofs for an article this afternoon that's on cultural competence and critiquing cultural competence, because I think it's basically a practice that maps racialized space. So I critiqued like the cartography in that practice. So that's coming out soon. That'll be out in probably the winter, I would expect. And right now I've got a grant to actually develop a K-12 curriculum for my book. So something that for my book project, I interviewed 20 people who identify as activist musicians, and 12 of them taught in some capacity, mostly teaching artists, but they wanted curriculum as like, they wanted something like in their hands to be able to kind of teach with, based on my research. So that has been a project that is something that I have been wanting to do since I started the book project. And it has finally kind of come to the surface of something that I'm working on. So I am doing things like lesson planning, which is lovely because I don't always get to do that for K-12 anymore. So that's been a fun project. So that'll be, it's in the works for a while anyway. So I'm thinking about that. I'm also working on a book project, co-editing with Deb Bradley, who's another anti-racist scholar in the field, and we're working on a book on music education and trauma. So thinking about what it might mean to have a trauma-informed music education and really engage with like trauma theory. I think I worry about the way that trauma gets taken up in the literature presently, because I think it's kind of become edgy speak. We're talking about it in a way that doesn't necessarily engage its complexity. And so this book is a way to kind of do the work of thinking about trauma in depth. And, or at least I hope it is. So that's a big project. And we've got chapters due in December. This is the second iteration of them. So they already came in August, and the whole project is due to the publisher at the end of May. So that's definitely going to occupy a lot of time for the next few months of my life.
Just another reminder that deadlines do not stop once you get your degree.
We hope you enjoyed this week's Coffee Talk.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Check us out wherever you listen to podcasts at Go Forth, a music education talk show. Join us next week for another Coffee Talk segment. We hope to see you then, but until next time, go forth and change the world.